I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, journalist Bill McKibben on what communities can do to reverse the effects of global warming. One of those effects predicted in the April report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is increased forest fires. So we turn first to Southern California, where gale force Santa Ana winds are inflaming wildfires. 300,000 people have now been evacuated. One man is dead and about 700 homes have burned. San Diego County Sheriff Bill Colander told reporters it's probably the worst fire the county has ever seen, and it's going to get worse. Tom Riopel is San Diego reporter for KNX 1070 in Los Angeles. He joins us now. Tom, where are you?
Well, right now, Robin, I'm actually in my home because I'm in one of 2,000 homes that are being threatened by what's being called the Harris Fire. Overnight, what happened is it was inland in the mountainous areas. It burned west toward the Pacific Ocean and is burning toward heavily populated areas along the coastline here in the South County of San Diego.
Well, what are you going to do? Are you waiting for, and how are you getting instructions?
Well, we have a system in San Diego. It's called a reverse 911. The county will call you, and they leave a message on your phone saying it's time for you to leave. So we're waiting for that phone call, and once it comes, we're gone.
Now, we understand people have been evacuated to stadiums, to schools. Where are some of the places that people are staying?
The biggest one is Qualcomm Stadium. That's where the Chargers play football. They've had about 10,000 people there spent the night, and they're expecting more today because of the evacuations in the South County. It's gotten so bad here. The Chargers, again, that play football, are going to Arizona to practice this week because they have a football game this Sunday, and chances are that game will not be played here in San Diego.
Sometimes when people outside of the Southern California area hear about fires, it feels as if it's a story that we've heard before and it passes and people just move back into their homes. Is there a sense that this one is different?
I can go back to 2003. We had the Cedar Fire out here. It was a huge fire. It killed 15 people. It was the worst thing we'd ever seen. Now, everyone I'm talking to, the authorities in San Diego, are saying this is even worse. There's just not enough manpower to control them. And yesterday, the winds were so erratic, there was so much smoke. For more than half of the day, we had no air tankers, no helicopters in the sky. I mean, they couldn't even try to fight the fire. This is imagine they're just trying to protect as many homes as they can, not even trying to aggressively attack it. We hope that all changes today.
384 square miles, we understand, are burning or have been burned. Tell us some of the other effects. Is school in session, for instance?
No, there are no schools in session throughout the entire San Diego County area. People are being advised, just stay home. Very unhealthy air outside. Stay indoors if you can. Do not use cell phones because they're afraid the overload will knock out some of the cell phone sites throughout the county. There's various things people are being asked to do. One of them, most importantly, is if you are asked to evacuate your home, get out right away.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that about cell phones because we've been trying to reach family members. Many people have, and you can't get through. That might be one of the reasons. Is there any sense of when this fire might switch course? We heard from the county sheriff that he believes things are going to get worse. So any sense of a weather change or anything that's going to stop it?
We hope things are going to change today. That's the weather forecast, is that these Santa Ana winds sometime this afternoon will cease, or at least decrease a little bit, and we'll get a bit of a break so firefighters can actually start aggressively attacking these fires.
Yeah.
One of the biggest problems have been people that own pets, and of course there's a lot of people that own horses and that kind of stuff, and finding places for them. We have a huge fairground out here in San Diego, and they're using that now as an evacuation center for people with horses. When you see homes going up in flames in an area like Rancho Santa Fe, that's probably one of the most exclusive areas in North America, you know things are totally out of control.
Tell us why. I mean, some would say, why should they be any different from other areas? But you're saying what?
They're huge. They're spread out mansions, basically. And the flames are burning from the east to the west. And it just keeps going and going and going. And, you know, there's concern that if this isn't stopped, it could go all the way to the ocean.
And explain to people, by going all the way to the ocean, then you're plowing through more congested neighborhoods.
Exactly, because obviously people love to live on the coast and love the water. So at that point, you have to get through all these communities to even get close to the water.
Right. Yeah, you're talking about developments, row after row of houses.
Yeah, thousands of homes. And I don't know how many homes we've lost already because, quite frankly, there's so much going on. Just in my county alone, San Diego County, we have fires burning from the extreme north all the way down to the Mexican border.
Yeah. And by the way, Tom, if you get that call, the reverse 911 from the city, where will you go?
I have a game plan. My stuff's ready to go. You want to get your family pictures, important paperwork, any medications you may need, aspirin, that kind of stuff, and perhaps some water, and just get out.
Yeah. Tom Riopel, San Diego reporter for KNX 1070 in Los Angeles, speaking to us from his home in San Diego. Tom, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Yes, you could win a Nobel, but there are other ways to fight global warming. And journalist Bill McKibben joins us for an extended conversation now on just that. He wrote what's acknowledged to be the most major book on global warming, The End of Nature. He's out now with a new book called Fight Global Warming Now, The Handbook for Taking Action in Your Community, a hands-on guide to stopping climate change, starting at the local level. Bill McKibben, welcome back to Here Now.
Well, it's so good to be here as always.
Yeah. First of all, I mentioned the Nobel, Al Gore. Conservative Bill Kristol said on Gore's Nobel, it was a bloviator getting an award from bloviators. Are you seeing in any tangible real shift because of the Nobel, or is it just something, you know, sort of preaching to the choir?
No, I think it's very much one more of the affirmations that this is so real that it can't be ignored. The choir gets larger all the time. 70% of Americans now understand that global warming is serious and that something needs to be done. And the number who are really ready to be active grows all the time. You know, there were 300,000 people evacuated from their homes in Southern California in the last 48 hours.
That's what you just heard, right?
A lot of those people are understanding, as the chief of San Diego Fire and Rescue said yesterday, this is the driest it's been in 90 years. You know, they won't ever be the same again, and one of the ways in which they won't be the same is in taking for granted that the natural world is going to operate the way it has in the past.
Well, let me just take 2 seconds on that, because we're not here to debate global warming, but rather for you to tell people some of the things you put together in your book. But as you know, there is a debate going. Are the fires out there because there's too much tinder and brush and fuel, as they call it, or is it something, you know, more serious? Are these more serious winds and drier than before?
You know, global warming, it's not like DNA. You can't do a paternity test on a fire and say this was caused by global warming. What you can say is all the computer models show us that all the things that are starting to happen, more drought from increased evaporation, more deluge and flood because once that water's in the atmosphere, it's going to come down someplace, bigger storms. These are just the kind of things that the computer models predict, and they're what we see now more and more and more.
Okay, well, your book is what people can do about it. And I just want to address right off a perception I think is widely held that taking action is something only towns with a lot of college students, like Middlebury, Vermont, where you started this project, or college graduates, or progressives, something only they can do. You write in the book about Appalachian communities responding to coal companies.
All around this country, in every kind of community now, people are responding. This is becoming, the movement to fight global warming is becoming the next civil rights movement, the next truly large national campaign. We launched this website, stepitup07.org, on January 10th last year, me and 6 college students. We had no money, we had no organization, so we had low expectations. Instead, in the course of 12 weeks, we managed to organize people in 1,400 communities around the country to hold rallies. All 50 states. The biggest day of grassroots environmental protests since Earth Day 1970. We're doing it again this fall. Same kind of spread across the country. Evangelical congregations, sorority chapters, chambers of commerce. This isn't, you know, some fringe thing. These are people understanding that more than any other issue, this is what will dominate life in the 21st century.
And by the way, what's the date you're hoping to do it again?
November 3rd.
Which is coming up. But you write that, and yet, with, you know, you believe you have the science, you know, the White House, President Bush acknowledging global warming. I mean, you have all of the things going, but you say despite that show last April, you don't have a movement, something that Malcolm Gladwell calls the tipping point.
We're getting close. It's impossible to underestimate the power of the forces on the other side. These are the biggest vested interests in the world. ExxonMobil made more money last year than any company in the history of money ever made. So it's a tough fight, but boy, is it launched and underway. And you can, if you go to stepitup07.org, you can see the pictures from around America. It's really breathtaking to see people holding underwater demonstrations off the Florida Keys or skiing in formation down these remote glaciated peaks in the far west. Or
they're on lakes in Minnesota. They're mountaintops in Wyoming, beaches in Hawaii, on stilts on mountains in Los Angeles. You can go to our website, here-now.org, and we'll link you to it as well. But let's get to some of the information that you've gleaned, not just from what happened last year, but you know, as you go ahead and put in this book. There's several things you say activists should do if they want to start this in community. First of all, make it credible. You write, contact a local expert. Go to a college. Get someone who's an expert on this.
To be an activist around this issue, you don't need to know everything about global warming. You need to know a little bit, and we lay that out in the book. But it does help to be able to go to someone, and there's now people at most colleges, say, who are knowledgeable about what the most local impacts will be, who have access to the latest computer data about what it's going to mean for snowpack in the Sierras, for the change in foliage and maple sugaring in New England, those kind of things.
The things that tell us what happens in the future are saying that New England will have no winter at all. The
Not
computer
at all.
Models.
The scientists at the University of New Hampshire, when they released a report a couple of years ago, used the phrase that struck to my heart since I love cross-country skiing. They said cross-country skiing and snowmobiling will be extinct in northern New England by mid-century unless we get our act together really fast.
Okay, so you're giving people ways to do that in their community. Contact local experts. Get fellows, people from clubs, teachers.
That's right. What we want people to do, I mean, there's been a lot of very good work in the last few years about sort of changing our individual lives and putting in the new light bulbs and things. Now we need a political movement that really makes sure that our representatives and senators and presidential candidates take this seriously. What our sort of unofficial slogan at Step It Up became was, sure, screw in the new light bulb, but then screw in the new federal policy, and really fast. That's the most important thing that we have to do, given the scale and the pace of this problem. Working one by one isn't going to get it done in time.
So get a lot of people going along with you. Get credibility. Know a little bit what you're doing. Make it snappy. You talk about Doreen Simmons. We have just about a minute. Tell us her story. She was in Barrow, Alaska. It doesn't take a lot of time to put together.
We had people manage to put together rallies in the course of a week that drew hundreds of people last time. We've still got people scheduling new rallies for November 3rd this time around on the website at stepitup07.org. All you need is an email list. If you have, 100 friends and they each have 100 friends, you're there.
Bill McKibben, author of Fight Global Warming Now, the Handbook for Taking Action in a Community. We'll have more with him after the break. He'll also tell us why his pledge, while they're trying to get the president to pledge to cut carbon emissions by at least 80% by 2050, seems like a big goal. How to be aware of companies that greenwash, how to know who your partners are if you're going to be active. Later in the show, we'll take a look at that conflict between Iraqi Kurds and Turkey. We'll have a close look at that as well. All of this is ahead in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more with journalist Bill McKibben, author of Fight Global Warming Now, the Handbook for Taking Action in Your Community. It's got all sorts of tips he's gleaned from actions in the past in April when, to just about everybody's surprise, a movement that it took, just 12 weeks to set up had thousands of people demonstrating across the country asking for more action against global warming. I want you to tell us, Doreen Simmons lived in Barrow, Alaska. What did she do?
She, in 3 days, managed to put together, activate her entire community, get a big float going, a big rally. They had musicians. They had everything else. You know, people feel powerless, right? Global warming is too big to take on. But in fact, there are 435 congressmen in this country. Each of us has one. Each of those congressmen can be moved, shifted with 100 people. 500 people taking action.
Can they really? Because the push from the other side is 500 lobbyists what seems like an immense task.
We don't have enough money to take them on, but we have enough people. We did a march last year across Vermont. It was really interesting. 1,000 people marching. managed to get all our congressional candidates to come meet with us. One of them really stuck in my mind. She was running on the Republican ticket for Congress, and she almost won, the adjutant general of the State National Guard. 2 months before, she'd said, "I don't know if global warming's real. More research needs to be done." The more research that needed to be done was how many people were going to walk across Vermont and demand that she take action. And we find that same thing happening in state after state after state.
Did she?
She signed our pledge to cut carbon emissions 80% by 2050.
Well, tell us about that pledge, because that, you know, it's one thing to change your light bulbs, wear a warmer sweater, you know, inflate the tires on your car, all these little things that we know that people can do to help reduce global warming, and they count. But then you have this pledge that you hope that Congress and the president sign, you and others, to cut carbon emissions at least 80% by 2050. What has to happen?
We need that kind of legislation, and soon, a cap on carbon and then a steady ratcheting down of the amount that people are allowed to, that fossil fuel industry is allowed to use.
A freeze on carbon emissions by 2010, somewhere.
Exactly. And you know, the effect of that will be to change the economic force of gravity so that all of a sudden it makes economic sense not to pour carbon into the atmosphere and wreck the environment. It makes economic sense to start figuring out how to save carbon from pouring into the atmosphere. It's the only thing that's on a big enough scale to really begin to change things here at home, and it's the only thing that'll give us the credibility to go talk to the Chinese and the Indians and everyone else and try to get the world on something like the same course.
I'm going along the list. A commitment to have the country produce 25% of its power from renewable sources such as the sun and wind by 2025. A government clean energy job corps program that provides access to jobs in order to jumpstart the retooling of our nation's energy system. Tell us more about that.
Look, we've got a lot of work to do. We got to put new insulation in tens of millions of homes. We got to put solar panels on tens of millions of roofs. They're not, you know, that insulation is not going to install itself. The good news is that that's work that can't be outsourced. You can't send your house to China to get it re-insulated. We need to put people to work here, people who've been left out of the old energy economy, put them to work building the new one.
It's sort of a Paul Krugman is going to be on the program soon talking about a new deal.
Exactly the heart of this. Exactly right.
You remind us, I mean, the book again, Fight Global Warming Now, the handbook for taking action in your community, is about going from worrying about it to organizing it. And you say that this is a very religious country, all the polls tell us so, and many people want to put their faith to use. So tap into churches, synagogues,
people
mosques.
People are doing it finally. It's so exciting to see, and not just in sort of liberal churches. The evangelical community has really taken a strong role in this in the last year, and it's exciting to watch it happening. Last week, the Vatican announced that Vatican City would become the first carbon-neutral nation on Earth. They're putting solar panels all over the top of St. Peter's. It's really starting to happen. All we need to do is accelerate it. And one of the good things that's happening, finally, is that students are no longer apathetic, no longer unconcerned. I wrote this book with my six colleagues are all 22. Mm-hmm. They're just graduated from Middlebury, where I teach. They're the people I organized StepItUp07.org with, and they're the able co-authors of this and part of a generation that's really starting to grab the reins.
You talk about enlisting businesses for help. First of all, they can donate things that you might need. But how do you beware of greenwashing, companies that maybe just have, you know, wrapped themselves in the issue, but they're not really walking the walk?
Here's my general rule of thumb. The more times you see a company use, like, penguins in an advertisement, the more likely it is they're actually continuing to wreck the earth. We need to ask a little bit deeper question than, like, how much money did you spend on your ad budget? It's, what are you doing for us? But business is beginning to get the news, especially those corporations that have significant exposure in Europe and Japan, where regulation and public opinion is even further along than it is here. They're not doing all that they need to do, but they're well ahead of, say, the Bush administration on the need for real change and real legislation to make that happen.
You have always been a local first guy. You in fact, last time you were here, you talked about every time if you buy food that's from somewhere else in the country, it's like ordering takeout from 4,000 miles away. Just figure out how much that really costs in the environment. But you also say if you are flying somewhere to do an event, if you're an activist, well, you got to do your carbon trade-off. You are adding to the problem. You've got to think of how much you are doing.
That's right. This is one of the reasons that we organized these Step It Up demonstrations in this unusual way. People said, oh, have a march on Washington. That's how it's done. Well, we didn't want to have a march on Washington because what sense does it make to have people crisscross the country spewing carbon behind them, you know, to protest global warming? What wonderful sense it made to have people in their local communities making sense of this for their people around them. I knew that when we got all these pictures back from April 14th uploaded to the website. There was one from Jacksonville, Florida. They went and they found a yacht and they found a crane and they winched that yacht 20 foot up in the air and said, that's where the ocean's going to be when Greenland slides into the sea. People in Jacksonville got it after that.
Love that image. I love the one of the people tubing down a river in Vermont, which a couple of years ago was ice. Now it's not. Bill McKibben, author of Fight Global Warming Now, the handbook for taking action in your community. To get to those pictures he's speaking of, go to our website here-now.org. Bill, thanks as always for coming by.
Robin, so much fun.
Yeah. We'll have more after the news here and now. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki says he's decided to close down the offices of the PKK, the Kurdish rebel party in northern Iraq. The decision came hours after Turkish officials rejected a ceasefire offer by the militant PKK. The crisis in Turkish-Iraqi-U.S. relations extends back to last week's vote by the U.S. Congress on whether the century-old killing of Armenians by Ottoman Empire Turks can be labeled a genocide. Days later, the Turkish parliament authorized sending troops into Iraq to pursue the militant PKK. Then this past weekend, the PKK staged a brazen ambush on Turkish soldiers, killing 12 and wounding 16. 8 Turkish soldiers are still missing. Turkey's prime minister says he withheld a counterattack after a personal request by Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. Well, we're joined now by Peter Galbraith. He's advised Kurds in northern Iraq and is also a former ambassador to Croatia. Ambassador Galbraith, the PKK, or the Kurdistan Workers' Party, they were behind the weekend attacks, and also their offices are now being closed in Iraq. What are they after?
They started out seeking independence in southeast Turkey, but they've given up on that. What they really want is to be reintegrated into the political life of Turkey, and they're basically their agenda is Kurdish rights, civil rights.
In Turkey?
Inside Turkey. This whole problem would go away, in my view, if Turkey were prepared to contemplate an amnesty for the PKK fighters and some of its leaders.
Well, you're also highly critical of the PKK, as we're going to hear. But first, tell us where this standoff on the border stands now.
Things are extremely tense. There are large numbers of Turkish troops poised to cross the border. The Turkish foreign minister was in Baghdad on Monday and Tuesday. He spoke with his Iraqi counterpart. They reached an agreement that there would be active measures against the PKK. But in effect, the PKK is carrying a loaded gun, and it can choose the moment which it fires and would provoke a major confrontation on the border, as it did last weekend.
Well, as we heard from a Turkish analyst last week, is there anything anyone can do about the PKK? The U.S. has its hands full with Sunni insurgents in the rest of the country. The Iraqi government doesn't seem to be able to do it. And politically, the leader of the Kurds doesn't seem to be able to do it. What do you think the sense is of anyone doing anything about the PKK attacks?
There are two issues. There's a military one and there's a political one. On the military side, the PKK is up in very remote mountainous regions. Their main base is not on the border with Turkey, but on the border with Iran in a place called Kandil Mountain. And I actually was up there in 1992, not when the PKK was there, but when an Iranian Kurdish group was up there. And at that time, it was blazing hot down in the valley. There was snow up on top of the mountains where the base is. Neither the Iraqi military nor the Kurdistan military, which controls that area, have helicopters that could be used to attack these bases. And so it's extremely difficult. And if Turkey came across, it would be a long way from Turkey, But if they attacked, they basically would destroy a few empty buildings because almost certainly the rebels would disperse before an attack.
Well, you know, you mentioned the border with Iran. Let's bring that facet of the story into play here because, as you well know, there are two Kurdish fronts, one the Kurdish separatists, the PKK, fighting Turkey, the other separatist Kurds fighting Iran. This is the PJAK, the Party for Free Life in Kurdistan. They're waging the same kind of war against Iran as the PKK is against Turkey, and yet the complaint from the Kurds is the U.S. calls the PKK a terrorist group. They're the ones attacking Turkey, and yet they seem to turn their back on the PJAK fighting Iran. Isn't that a political problem?
It's very strange because PJAK is a part of the PKK. It is the Iranian branch of the PKK. And, of course, the Iranians see this difference. They imagine that the U.S. is not only turning a blind eye, but they imagine that the U.S. is supporting PJAK. And I think that is a factor in their thinking. If the U.S. is fomenting violence inside Iran, then they're entitled to launch retaliatory attacks against U.S. troops through their Shiite proxies in Iraq.
Yeah. It gets further complicated because, as you write in an op-ed piece in the New York Times, Turkey is very involved with Iraqi Kurdistan, providing 80% of the foreign investment.
Although the conventional wisdom in Washington is that Turkey cannot stand the thought of an independent Kurdistan in Iraq, the fact of the matter is that Turkey has accepted this as a reality. And even such hardline military figures as Kenan Evren, who was the last military president of Turkey, have said an independent Kurdistan in Iraq is a reality, and we have to live with it. And Turkey's approach on the ground has actually been very pragmatic. They have had good political relations with the leaders of Kurdistan, and most importantly, they have encouraged Turkish companies that have provided 80% of the foreign investment. There's been a booming trade between Iraqi Kurdistan and Turkey.
So you have advised the Kurds. What would your advice to the Kurds be at this point?
Well, the first point to understand is that the PKK is not just an enemy of Turkey. It is also an enemy of the two main political parties that control Iraqi Kurdistan, the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. In the 1990s, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, the KDP, fought alongside Turkish troops against the PKK. So they have no interest in the success of the PKK. The political problem they face is that their population, as Iraqi Kurdistan has become more democratic, doesn't want to have a return to fighting between Kurds, and they certainly don't want to have casualties in the Kurdistan army of that kind of magnitude. Nonetheless, I think the Iraqi Kurdistan leaders have to take very seriously what Turkey is saying, and I think there are measures that they can take short of military action. This would include putting their own people on the checkpoints leading up to Kandil Mountain. It would include either interdicting leaders as they travel back and forth across Iraqi Kurdistan territory. It would include disrupting the logistics until the PKK makes clear, not just in words, but in deeds, that all its military activities inside Turkey end.
And just remind us why this is so important. Kurdistan, one of the great success stories in Iraq, just take a few seconds and remind us. Secular, women have a lot of freedoms, it's a pretty functioning society. Tell us more.
Kurdistan is the only success story in Iraq. It is very pro-Western. It's stable. There have been almost no terrorist incidents there. It is booming economically. It is precisely what the Bush administration hoped all of Iraq would turn out to be. And a Turkish attack could destabilize this one successful part of Iraq. And that certainly will not be appreciated by the Bush administration, for whom Iraq is its signature project, nor, I think, by most Americans. The last thing we need with 160,000 troops on the ground is a major new trouble area. And so, in turn, an attack into Iraqi Kurdistan will do great damage to U.S.-Turkish relations, which are already at a very low point due to the mismanagement of that relationship over the last 7 years. And it would certainly do a major blow to Turkey's chances of joining the European Union. There's just a huge amount at stake in this whole issue.
Peter Galbraith, former U.S. ambassador to Croatia and an advisor to the Kurds in northern Iraq. Ambassador Galbraith, thanks for speaking with us.
Very good to speak to you, Robin.
Okay, before the hour's up, fly fishing for relief from cancer. You're listening to Here and Now. Food banks in Michigan are asking for help from the public so they can keep providing meals to people in need. According to today's Detroit News, the Gleaners Community Food Bank of southeastern Michigan, which provides food for more than 400 soup kitchens, homeless shelters, churches, and food pantries in the metro Detroit area, is running out of food. They say they need 2 million pounds of food by Thanksgiving to make sure 250,000 people don't go hungry on that holiday. Jerry Brisson is Vice President of Development for Gleaners. Jerry, you know, as you know, unfortunately, we're used to hearing this sort of call from food banks and shelters across the country around this time of year. Is this really worse for you than in past years?
It is worse, and it's really due to a couple of things. We've had a drop-off in our national food donations of almost 1 million pounds of food, and at the same time, we've had a pretty steep increase in demand. Both of these things in Michigan here, we've tracked for a while, and it's not totally unexpected that we would see some drop-off in the national pipeline of food.
Why? Why do you think that is?
Because the national people that manufacture food, which is where the food bank gets a lot of food, are much more efficient than they were back in the day when food banks got started. They have better systems in place. They also have alternative markets where they can sell food, like to the dollar stores and places like that.
Let's explain what you mean. When you say that companies like Kraft or Kellogg's and Tyson are more efficient, it means that they have less mistakes in their products. Isn't that what you're saying? And so that's sort of, you know, a box of cereal that might have too many raisins, they don't have as many of those.
That's correct. I mean, that's certainly, it's more complex than that, but that's a good example. If they had a labeling issue where the weight of what's in the can or what's in the box is actually heavier or lighter than what it says on the can, that kind of mistake would lead to them not being able to sell it through the regular retail market.
So you're not getting as much of that kind of food donated.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's correct. And there's also pressure on farming to be more efficient, and so there's certainly less food to be wasted even from the very get-go.
And, of course, when you say wasted, you mean to come to your clients who desperately need it.
That's exactly right. You know, prior to food banks, which, you know, pretty much got started about 30 years ago, that food was, in fact, getting wasted. And food banks were formed to give a reliable way to take that food that was being wasted and distribute it to pantries, soup kitchens, shelters, and then to the hungry families that need it. That's correct.
And what about the other side of the equation? You said you have more demand. Can you give us some numbers on that?
In the first 9 months of this year, 2007, we've actually distributed 2.2 million pounds of food more than the first 9 months of 2006. That's about a 13% increase for us. The trends that we watch are things like here in southeast Michigan, the United Way has a 211 helpline. Their calls for food assistance in September rose 60%. So we know that the demand isn't going to be lessening in the next few months as we're watching the trends. So we expect that our holiday distribution is going to be bigger than ever.
Well, and we all read the news. We know that Michigan itself is in trouble because of the car industry. And we understand that the state budget has been a problem, less money in the state budget to buy surplus food from Michigan farmers.
That's exactly correct. And so when you've got less food in the pipeline and at the same time a pretty substantial increase in demand, it's time to let the community know to step up or else families will have to be denied assistance, and that would be the last thing that we would want to see.
Well, I'm seeing that this gets particularly tough in some communities that have even higher numbers. Julie Highfield, who runs one of the food pantries that depends on Gleaners, that's Open Arms Food Pantry, and that's in Pontiac, Michigan, she says her demand is up 70%.
Well, that's exactly right. And you'll see suburban poverty actually on a percentage basis increasing much more rapidly than urban poverty. And so those poverty statistics that are just numbers in a book to some people, for us, those are faces of families that are reaching out for help. 90% of the United Way's calls for food assistance are first-time calls for assistance. These are families that are just now finding themselves at or below the poverty line because of, you know, could be sickness, unemployment, chronic unemployment, particularly where you have people that had higher paying jobs taking lower paying jobs and just suffering the consequences of those lower paying jobs.
Jerry Brisson, Vice President of Development for the Gleaners Community Food Bank of southeastern Michigan, putting out a call for support. Jerry, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you.
Okay, and in just 1 minute, Gone Fishing with Cancer. After our break, Here and Now. next week in Fall River Mills, California. A dozen men will take part in the season's last fishing trip from Real Recovery. Real Recovery, which is spelled R-E-E-L, is not a travel agency. It's an organization that provides men with cancer the chance to talk, have fun, develop new perspectives on recovery, life, and death, all for free while fishing. Gary Wallach of the NPR show Only a Game attended Real Recovery's Emigrant Montana retreat this past summer. He brings us the story.
Montana's Paradise Valley runs about 50 miles from the city of Livingston to Yellowstone National Park. On this hot, windy Tuesday afternoon, tourists in RVs, motorcycles, and rental cars hurtle through the valley on their way to the park's north entrance. Amid the drone, a group of 13 men arrives at Dome Mountain Ranch. But they're not tourists. Most are local residents with at least one thing in common.
Fishing. The big word was fishing. Fly fishing.
That's 63-year-old Mickey Riley, who was diagnosed with colorectal cancer less than 2 years ago. Riley heard about Real Recovery at a cancer center in Bozeman, Montana. He admits that fishing provided the hook for him to attend this retreat, but the opportunity to talk about his illness landed him here.
I felt like that it was something that was going to help me out just a little bit, and with my recovery, I thought, you know, I'm just going to give it a try.
35 years, I haven't seen some of the people go to this reunion. I'm thinking, wow.
The 13 participants here in Emigrant range from 46 to 74 years old and have been diagnosed with a variety of cancers. Within minutes of their arrival, it's time for a meeting. Real Recovery co-founder and program director Coy Theobald, a short, effervescent man with a carefully groomed white beard, facilitates today. He shares the story of his recovery from squamous cell carcinoma 5 years ago and invites participants to introduce themselves. Before long, the room is alive with stories of surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and difficulties with finances and family life. Mickey Riley says he doesn't worry about working and earning anymore. He may have only months to live. But today, he's troubled by something else.
But what I think I lost the most out of this situation is the fact that in my family, I've always been the caretaker. Now it seems like everybody's taking care of me. Now, knowing that in the near future, maybe I'm hoping not real near future, but in the near future, I'm going to be gone.
How's that hit you?
Hard.
Yeah. I see that.
On Wednesday morning, after three meetings in less than 24 hours and a lot of difficult discussion, it's time to fish. The men meet their fishing buddies, professional guides, and local enthusiasts who have volunteered 2 days of their time. Then, Real Recovery Executive Director Stan Golub summons the group to a table covered with vests containing everything the men will need for 2 days of fishing. But he points out, these vests carry something else.
These are the names of every participant who has been in the Real Recovery program so far. There are over 400 names on these vests, beginning in June of 2003. And we want you to add your name, date, place to this legacy. And you will always remain a part of Real Recovery and a part of these vests. Pick your size, sign your vest, and then we're ready to go fishing. Oh,
nice.
Nice job, Jim.
The Yellowstone River is low and warm due to a summer-long heat wave and drought, and the fishing is poor. But that's not the case at a private lake cradled in the hills above the ranch.
Woohoo!
Yeah, baby.
All right.
Wow, wait. Okay.
It's a beauty.
Beautiful.
Awesome.
Participants hoop and holler, encourage and rib each other. If the meetings help the men confront their cancer, the fishing helps them forget about it for a while. After Wednesday's outing, fishing buddy Lauren Cantrell explains why he's volunteered the last 2 years.
I've known quite a number of people that have been affected by cancer, and I thought, what a great combination of things, you know, coming together. Just because there's a, you know, I love to fly fish, and it seems to me that there's something more important out there to do with it other than just to fly fish for myself. I think for anybody, whether or not you have cancer or not, there's something therapeutic about hearing the sound of water constantly in the background.
Cantrell's morning partner, 62-year-old retiree Ron Krager, hadn't been fly fishing in 32 years. But the sounds and the feelings connected with the sport are still familiar to him.
When you're out there on the water, you're focused on the now. And everything else fades away. And then when you're in the discussions, it's the same thing. You're totally focused on the sport, the stories, and everything else fades away.
How was the fishing today?
The fishing was good. The catching was poor.
Was the sound of the water enough?
Oh, yes. Yep.
On Thursday morning, the last day of the retreat, men chat about diagnoses and treatments and fishing over breakfast. Then final meeting. What gifts do you have in your life today because you have cancer?
My name is Mark, and I haven't worked for 4 months. And quite frankly, you know, those 4 months, I was such a hard worker before. Now I get to spend time with my family and come close to them. I'm starting to bring them together because they were starting to fall apart. Sorry. It's just been a real welcome.
I was afraid of cancer. And I, you know, the idea that I would ever get cancer would seem the most remote thing. But I'm not afraid of it anymore. I got to know it very intimately, and I may know it even more intimately someday. But I'm not afraid of it.
Coy Theobald and Stan Golub say they're frustrated they can't do more for the men after retreats are over. Still, Golub says, real recovery's benefits are often lasting ones.
We'll often hear from their spouse or from their child who will tell us that that Bob or Bill or Jim wore his real recovery hat every day until the day he died. Or he's got the picture, the framed photo that we send after each retreat of the group. And he has that at his bedside at his hospice and would look at it and talk about it every day about his experience at Real Recovery. And that's how we know that this program lasts well beyond the retreat itself.
I'm Mickey, and I've learned that there's a lot of caring people out there.
On Thursday afternoon, Mickey Riley struggles with words during the closing ceremony. He stands in a circle with his 12 fellow survivors, who also share what they'll take with them as they leave. The buddies stand to the outside with their hands on the shoulders of their fishing partners. On the inside of the circle, Coy Theobald walks from man to man and offers a benediction to each. The men form a tight circle with clenched fists, and they repeat the Real Recovery motto, the one the staff hopes will help carry them through whatever lies ahead.
Fish on!
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, my goodness.
The buddies present each participant with a box of hand-tied flies. After some tears, a few jokes, and handshakes, the 13 men climb into their cars and their pickup trucks. They pull out onto Route 89 and scatter before the hard winds of Paradise Valley.
Our visit to the Real Recovery Fishing Retreat in Emigrant, Montana was brought to us by Gary Wallach of NPR's Only a Game. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.